As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Let's bring in now Lord Robert Skidelsky. He is Emeritus Professor of Political Economy at the University of Warwick, member of the House of Lords, of course. And Lord Skidelsky, it's great to have you with us. Thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
I don't think that that Donald Trump would call himself a Keynesian, but in light of what he's proposing here, all of these tax cuts, all of this infrastructure spending, is he a sort of neo-Keynesian? Does he have a foot in the school, let's say?
Look, no one in the United States has ever called themselves a Keynesian, even in the heyday of the Keynesian economics. It was always the new economics. They don't like the thought that they're taking their economics from someone else. So, of course, he wouldn't have called himself a Keynesian. But if you add up the package, the tax cuts and the infrastructure spending, the implications are very Keynesian. I mean, of course, you can argue about the detail, who benefits from his particular tax proposals and so on. But broadly, it's a stimulus package and a fiscal stimulus package. And that, in my way of thinking, is Keynesian.
He's talked about this on the campaign trail in broad strokes. Now he's been elected. There are a few months here until he takes office. What are you going to be looking for? What are you going to be listening for as that package comes together?
Well, I'd be listening for the detail of it, and of course you'd have to gauge the political situation. I mean, it goes against the conservative instincts, the instincts of the Republicans, who have, of course, been very austerity minded, and he hasn't repudiated austerity. In other words, he's left everything quite ambiguous in terms of rhetoric, but the thrust of the policy was very clearly actually spelt out in the Financial Times by one of his leading advisors, and I can't remember his name. And he said, look, if this package causes the economy to grow, as I think it will, then the debt GDP ratio will fall automatically. It is the way of balancing the budget. That is, to get the economy to grow more strongly. If it can grow by 3-4% a year rather than 1-2% a year, you're on the way to licking the budget problem. And that is total 100% Keynesianism.
From where you sit, does it make sense? Does it stand to make a difference in the short term, if not the medium term or the long term?
Well, all these policies have to be taken in medium term, including, say, the inflation target. I mean, it's ridiculous to say, you know, as soon as the central bank does this, inflation rate will go up or down. That's not the point. The medium term target is important, but some of the programs should be what's called shovel ready. And then the other thing is expectations, isn't it? I mean, once business knows that certain things are going to happen, they will be able to gear up for them, and that will have an effect before they actually happen. So the timing of the thing is not very, very clear, but there should be some short-term effects just through the expectation channel.
With us this morning, Robert Skidelsky, here in our studios in London, and of course, his three volumes on John Maynard Keynes, but much more, his treatise After the Crash, I thought was just wonderful. So a book that conservatives and liberals alike could get much out of. We have so much for you this hour. David Gura in New York. I'm Tom Keene in London. Robert Skidelsky, you write of history. you're right, of political history. The conservatives sometimes grumble at Skidelsky economics. I want to do a little Keynes and Hicks ISLM theory. A lot of people, including President-elect Trump, are talking about moving the real economy curve, the IS curve, out with stimulus. In this distortion of interest rates that we have now, is the real economy curve attached to the LM curve, attached to the money curve, or are we so distorted those models don't work?
Well, we are distorted in one very important respect, which is once the policy rate hit the zero bound, almost, you know, as low as it could go, you ran out of monetary policy tools. So you lost any ability by orthodox interest rate policy to affect the real economy. That tool just disappeared once you'd hit zero. So you had to do something else. Now, I would have said at that point, you should have, this is, we're talking about 2010, 2011, even a bit earlier, you should have gone for fiscal. But they didn't, because at that moment, the whole emphasis was on austerity. The whole fear was that governments would default, that they were in such big debt crisis that you couldn't use fiscal policy, so they used monetary policy. And monetary policy was just printing money, essentially. And it was trying to do the job of interest rate policy. But unfortunately, it didn't work. Because you can, you know, as the saying is, you can bring the horse to water, but you can't actually make it drink. And there were too many leaks in monetary policy for it to really revive the economy.
Help us with a liberal interpretation of how to deal with Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican President. I mean, we've seen that for a cup of coffee. I believe it was in the early 70s. It really harkens back almost to Coolidge in the 1920s, doesn't it?
Yeah, but Coolidge didn't have the same ideas as Trump. I mean, Coolidge was a fiscal conservative. Well, most people were fiscal conservatives in those days. My take on it is that a Republican Congress, even if it were wholly committed to austerity policy, would not be able to defy a president with a mandate to get the economy moving in the way he promised. And it's his own party, after all. They'll give him some leeway. They're bound to do that.
Robert Skidelsky with us. In his book from a few years ago, folks, Keynes, The Return of the Master, I really can't say enough about it. It's a book that you can love to agree and disagree with. It is beautifully, unlike his biographies of Keynes, which were what, 4,000 pages each?
Weekend reading for you, Tom.
Old,
that's right.
They were like Old Testament length.
Don't let's exaggerate.
Keynes, The Return of the Master, highly readable, and I'll put it out on Twitter here today. Moving forward, a global dialogue, a national dialogue on a most historic Tuesday. David, just remarkable, it was a week ago.
Hard to believe.
It seems like it was a month ago.
Exactly. It's been a long week.
But we have someone that conservatives love to hate. He is the arch-liberal, the great political economist of John Maynard Keynes, Robert Skidelsky, in our studios in London. How do you respond to conservatives that say, oh, there goes that liberal again? What can you take away from a conservative ethos, particularly an American conservative ethos, as Donald Trump comes to power?
Well, Donald Trump is a hybrid, isn't he? I mean, he's not a classical conservative by any means. I don't know where he comes from. I mean, he's put together all the ideas that he seems to hold. He's drawn on a variety of sources. But I think he understands one thing, that a lot of Americans felt betrayed by the economic policies of the last 10, 15 years. I mean, we know that in the data, don't we? And American median incomes have fallen. Real wages of vast swathe of the population are lower than they were even 15 years ago. So he knows that, and he knows what the sources of discontent are. So he also knows you can't just have more of the same thing. Now, whether he genuinely believes that a stimulus is the right way, to deal with the problems of jobs. I don't know, but certainly that's what he said. And that is not a classic conservative position.
Yeah, you write about Trumponomics in your most recent column for Project Syndicate, and I was struck by the call that you make here for, I think, Democrats here in the U.S. in particular to at least engage with Trumponomics. You write that it might have some positive potential. You're saying here, don't reject it out of hand.
No, and neither did Bernie Sanders, and neither does Joe Stiglitz. I mean, all these people say, look, there are good things here in the program. Let's make it better. Now, they don't therefore commit to all the other things that Trump has disgracefully stood for. Of course they don't. But, I mean, here's something you can work on, and let's try and make it work. I think that's only sensible. Barring some totally unforeseen event, he's going to be president for the next 4 years. You've got to try and make sure the policy works.
We were speaking with Neil Ferguson a couple of days ago, and he said very explicitly, very concisely, this is not the 1930s.
Yeah.
From your vantage, with your historical perspective, give us the analog. Is that an appropriate analog to look back at the 1930s?
Well, it's appropriate in the sense that there's this feeling that an existing order is in a state of profound crisis. But there are many, many differences, and I think one or two of those differences are very, very important. First of all, there's a constitution in the United States that limits the power of the president. The president may seem all-powerful abroad, but at home, the president is not all-powerful. There was nothing in the Weimar Constitution of Germany to limit Hitler's power domestically. So, I mean, that's one very, very important difference. The second is that the crisis was much worse in the 1930s than it is today, and it came out of the most savage war of modern times. Now, all that is lacking. So, actually, the feeling is not nearly as despondent or angry as it was in that period. And I think we've got to bear that in mind because, I mean, when, you know, we've been used to something that's so tranquil, really,
right,
that any change, you know, strikes us
30
as being.
Seconds, Lord Skidelsky. When does Labour get its act together in England? What is the Labour Party? They're waiting for you to come to the rescue.
Well, it first got its act together in 1945. They are, of course, on the same wave as far as fiscal policy is concerned. They've come out against austerity. They should have come out against austerity 5 years ago. They didn't. But now they are. They're fully signed up to an infrastructure program, and not placing priority on deficit reduction.
Thank you so much for coming in today to our world headquarters. Robert Skidelsky, folks, I put out on Twitter his wonderful book on Keynes, A Return of the Master, and looking at stimulus, which was remarkably prescient in 2010, as we look at both candidates in the U.S., Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump, talking up stimulus. And, of course, President-elect Trump will try to put that into effect. That would be a good time to bring in Luigi Zingales of the Booth School in Chicago. As a gentleman of Italian persuasion, he has written brilliantly on the culture and fabric of America. Professor Zingales, after a Trump victory, can a president somehow boost consumption in Y equals C plus I plus G plus NX? Can any given president move the C?
Certainly, a massive sort of reduction in taxes could boost the C. Also, you can increase G, which is government expenditure. I think Trump has announced from the very first beginning that he's going to boost infrastructure spending. So I think he's going to do it. And he's going to spend more in defense. So I think everything is suggesting a higher deficit and probably higher inflation.
How much of this is a continuum? Do you see this as a continuum, going from the Brexit vote to the referendum in Colombia to the U.S. presidential election and now the referendum in Italy, all part and parcel of the same thing?
I think that the Brexit vote and the Trump vote are indeed very similar because they represent a revolt of voters against an economic system that doesn't seem to benefit them sufficiently. I think that the Italian story is quite different. I think this referendum is a self-inflicted wound. Renzi could have avoided having a referendum. He thought he could win big time. And now he finds himself sort of at the risk of losing. Now, the referendum...
Well, let me. I want to frame this up here, folks. Professor Zingales, of course, at Booth School, but he's been more than cordial with us over the years to speak of his Italian economy. And what has changed, David Gura, is our interview yesterday with David Folkerts-Landau, an esteemed writer of economic papers, with Michael Dooley and Peter Garber. And here's Folkerts-Landau yesterday heatedly speaking of the importance of the Italian referendum, not only, folks, for all of Italy, but all of Europe and, indeed, the global economy. Professor Zingales, do you agree with Dr. Folkerts-Landau that this is a time of moment for your Italy?
Yes and no, in a sense. I want to emphasize that the referendum is about some rather technical aspects of the Constitution that don't per se mean much. However, it is perceived as a moment in which Renzi takes his government and he might end up losing and could be the spark in a room full of gasoline. I think that the Italian situation has been dire for a long time. The problem has been sort of anesthetized by Draghi and the quantitative easing, but it's not been resolved. And sooner or later, we have to take out the anesthesia and the problem will resurface. Whether this is about to take place on December 4th or a little bit later, that I don't know. But sooner or later, will take place.
Help us understand what happens here if this referendum does not pass. What are the next steps here for Mr. Renzi?
So he announced that if he will lose the referendum, he will resign. Now, unfortunately, I don't have so much confidence that he will follow through on his word. Fortunately, I don't know, but the tradition of Italian politicians is not like the one of British politicians, that when they say something, they follow through, like Cameron. I think that the most likely scenario is that either Renzi will stay in power anyway, or there will be a coalitional government very similar to the existing one with some other figurehead. I don't think that there will be a dramatic change in anything. However, it will make Italy look less stable. And as I said, this could be the spark.
David Gura here in New York, Tom Keene in London this week. Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. A pleasure to have with us Luigi Zingales, Robert McCormick, Distinguished Professor of Entrepreneurship and Finance at the Booth School at the University of Chicago. We were talking about the Italian referendum, among other things, and there is a lot to talk about here. It strikes me that a thread running through that vote, the U.S. presidential election, the vote in Colombia, the vote in the U.K. a few months back as well, Luigi, is this notion of inclusion. There's been a lot of talk about including more people in economic success. What's it going to take to bring that from being lip service, talking about inclusion, to actually doing something about it in light of what we've seen here?
Let me first say that I think the Italian referendum is different because Italy did not have any economic success in the last 20 years. So before a problem of inclusion, in Italy there is a problem of creation. In the United States and Great Britain, there is a problem of inclusion. And the question is how to make, first of all, how to give opportunities to everybody. I think that some people feel they're left out, and they are. If you don't have a decent primary and secondary education, you start from such a disadvantage that is very hard to make up in life. The second is I think there is an increase in industry concentration that brings sort of higher prices that damage consumers. So I think having an agenda of enforcing more antitrust could be very beneficial to spread the benefits of innovation to everybody. And Trump has sort of paid lip service to this idea but I doubt he's going to actually implement it once he's in office.
I think we last spoke after John Stumpf stepped down from Wells Fargo as CEO. We were talking a bit about banking regulation. Now that the election is over with, forecast out a bit for us here. The news yesterday that Mary Jo White, the chair of the SEC, is going to step down at the end of President Obama's term. What does the regulatory landscape look like? You bring up antitrust. Certainly there are a number of mergers here waiting for a stamp of approval or a rejection from the Department of Justice.
I think that, again, you have to make a forecast of which Trump we're going to see in action as a president. I think Trump has at least two images. One is the populist image that actually talks against the AT&T and Time Warner merger, the one that sort of seemed to be changing this attitude. And then we have the more traditional sort of Republican conservative who says we should get rid of all this regulation and we should let firms do whatever they want. And I think at the end of the day, probably the second one would prevail, not the first one.
Luigi, help me here with amplitude. Lawrence Summers, writing in the FT, I believe it was, the other day, on, okay, you can have stimulus, but how much is enough? I know the University of Michigan's done a lot of study on this, Matt Shapiro, and I would assume out of Booth School you've done it as well. Do we underestimate how much stimulus it takes to move the needle to shift the IS curve?
Actually, honestly, I think that probably in the United States we are at the wrong moment in the cycle to stimulate the economy. I think that this is not a decision that comes from economics. This is the decision that comes from politics in order to try to give an opportunity in the job to middle-class, uneducated white folks who voted for Trump. And probably there are better ways to deal with the problem, but this is certainly the simplest one.
How much does composition matter? Again, the thing is so inchoate right now. We've heard about tax cuts. We've heard about $500 billion up to $1 trillion here. Tom asks about size. What in the medium term makes a difference compositionally?
I think that actually focusing on defense and construction is what probably will bring the biggest bang for the buck, because both of these activities have a huge U.S. content, I would say probably almost 100% U.S. content. Anything other form of stimulus increased consumption, but consumption means also import, and then the impact on the economy will be different. So I think that partly for ideological reasons, but partly for economic reasons, the stimulus will be focused on these two particular sectors. So the impact, I think, will be quite big.
Amid all of this uncertainty about policy, are the looming questions about the individuals Donald Trump is going to appoint to key jobs in his administration, including Treasury Secretary. In this day and age, what is the role of the Treasury Secretary? Do we place particular importance on him in this administration as doing more here to guide, to craft and to guide economic policy?
Oh, certainly. I think that Trump is not particularly experienced in economic policy, and I use like a British understatement.
Uh-huh.
So he will depend very heavily on his advisors, and the people who are in place now have a gigantic opportunity of shaping the agenda. So I think that the personality and the track record of the people chosen is very important.
You know, Luigi, I look at all this in the historic moment. What it's about is Republican, Republican, Republican. Give us your thoughts, and particularly with your wonderful book on capitalism, about a gridlock-free Washington, or is that a fiction?
No, I think that probably we're going to have a short period of unity in Washington. If we don't have it now, then people will revolt, and rightly so. There is a united government, and so they better reconcile. And I think that if there is one positive thing to be said about Trump, is that he's experienced in deals. So I think he's going to go with the way to have a deals that make him look good at this up front. And also the Republican establishment desperately need a deal. I think that not approving any package that Trump proposes will make the senators and the representatives and the Republican side look like idiots, because they've opposed Obama for 8 years. now they pose also this precedent and said that what do you want? So I think that we are poised for a deal. The question is, how good this deal will be in the short and in the long term.
Yeah, I think of what Jim Bullard of the St. Louis Fed a couple of days after the election about how, you know, at least the prospects for action in Congress are higher than they were. And of course, that's coming from a very low – there was a very low bar before then. But let me ask you lastly here, just when you look at the agenda, we've talked about the prospects for a big infrastructure package. Donald Trump has talked about tax reform with real seriousness. So has House Speaker Paul Ryan. What's the likelihood of that happening? Big corporate tax reform and what else from the economic agenda laid out on the campaign trail do you think we could see movement on here in the next Congress?
So I expect a reduction in corporate taxes. The question is, what is the effect of this? In a sense, if this reduction in tax rate is joined by an increase in the base, an increase in the in enforcement, a reduction, and so on and so forth, this could be a very good thing. If it's simply sort of a slashing of the rate, this is going to create a gigantic hole in the deficit, and sooner or later, we're going to have to pay for that.
You know, I look, Luigi, at, I guess, the economics of where we are, and clearly the idea that within the new populism culture and demographics and populism subsume all in economics. I don't buy it for a minute. The summary here, before we let you go, is an absolute primal scream for economic growth. It's my chart of the year, folks, from essentially 4% down to 2% real GDP. Where does the economic growth come from, if from anything but investment, and can policy spur investment?
I think that there will be some increase in investment, not only in infrastructure, but also private investment. I think that I'm pretty sure that Trump will do something to bring back the money that corporations have abroad. And so there will be a moment in which corporations are flush with even more money and will be under strong pressure to invest it. So I think that in the short term, we're going to have a boost in investments. Whether this will last long term remains to be seen.
Luigi Zingales, thank you so much. He's with the Booth School of Chicago. I'll tell you, David, it's just extraordinary to talk to Luigi Zingales about the U.S. and his Italy. Italy's been front and center here, starting with Folkerts Landau yesterday. It seems to be the topic of discussion, maybe more than Brexit.
A lot of talk about what's happening in the Netherlands next. I mean, we have a host of these referendum votes coming up in Europe.
Yeah. I think that's true. There's going to be a real geographical feel, but then it all goes back to here, at least, to London, and I would assume my observation that London is certainly surprising the skeptics and doing better than good. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent, registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role is to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
In a couple of days, the Fed Chair Janet Yellen will head up to Capitol Hill to testify before the Joint Economic Committee. And I wonder the degree to which she will be asked about the effects of this election on the economy so far as we've felt them thus far. Gary Stern is the former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Kind enough to join us here in the studio. Nice to see you.
Good morning.
What do you expect to hear from Janet Yellen? We've seen these undulations, these massive moves in the markets quieting a bit here today. What do you expect she'll face when she sits at that table on Thursday morning?
Well, I think Janet herself is likely to be quite cautious because, you know, it's early days and talk is cheap. And so there's lots of ideas floating around. But you know, how many of those ideas actually turn into action and policy and so forth remains to be seen. So that's what I expect from her. I suppose, you know, if I were asking her questions, I'd want to get a feel for, you know, what she thinks is appropriate for the Federal Reserve. Let's assume that there is a significant tax cut. Let's assume there's a significant increase in federal spending on infrastructure, possibly on defense, et cetera. You know, what's the appropriate Fed policy under those circumstances, or at least at a minimum, how does she think they will affect the economy? How does she think they'll affect the budget deficit, et cetera, et cetera? At least that's where I'd start.
How much assuming is going on inside the Eccles building right now? We hear so much about the potential for policy, new policy from President-elect Donald Trump. We haven't seen much in the way of details yet. Does that force caution or force, as you're saying here, assumption, planning out what all the scenarios might be?
Well, in some sense, both. Because, first of all, the Fed is inherently a cautious institution. Let's not forget that. But the Fed, you know, the Fed has some quite sophisticated economic models that enables them to analyze the effects of various actions. And they can run as many scenarios as they feel like. So, you know, they're not constrained in terms of their analytical capabilities at all, nor are they constrained in bringing, you know, independent judgment and experience to all this. The problem they face, as we commented earlier, is, you know, at this stage, there are lots of things out there floating around. Nothing is very concrete. We don't even know at this point, of course, who the players are going to be from the administration side, for the most part. So, you know, that's why I think while the Fed can run infinite numbers of scenarios, they're going to be cautious about placing any bets at this point. I would think they would avoid bet placing.
All right. Gary, I would suggest that you have been one of the great, great thinkers of this Fed, and of course, with a wonderful idea that you were not infected in Washington and had the sense to stay in Minneapolis, that being a good thing. What is our central economics now? Is this a Phillips curve Fed? Is this a Fed that is unorthodox? Or is this a Fed, as Stanley Fisher lectured at the Economic Club of New York a couple weeks ago, is this a Fed just searching for a conventional ISLM model?
Well, I think if I were trying to describe it, Tom, I would say this is a Phillips curve Fed, but people are confronted with, you know, high employment and low inflation, people have to be questioning the viability of that approach. And so, you know, I guess I would say it's probably a Phillips curve Fed with only modest conviction about that. And I think your reference to ISLM, you know, is obviously a starting point if you start to think about fiscal stimulus, but it's not necessarily the ending point. And the reason I would say it's not the ending point is that I think there's a real difference between what I would call responsible or judicious fiscal stimulus and fiscal stimulus that is so outsized and prospective federal budget deficits are so large for so long that, you know, they're perverse. And you don't get as much stimulus, in fact, out of it as you might expect. You get a reaction that says, boy, this doesn't look sustainable to us. This is trouble. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that fiscal stimulus will be responsible, but I'm not convinced at this point that it will be.
Is the outcome here of what's called a more assertive Republican House, Senate, and president that this is a Federal Reserve that becomes ever more ex post, that they have to wait and wait for the evidence, and ever more the institution reacts after the fact?
Well, that clearly has been the stance, and I don't get the sense that preemptive action is something that a majority of Fed policymakers are in favor of right now, and I think they'd have trouble justifying it in any event. You know, it hasn't, in defense of what they've been doing, it hasn't worked out badly so far. I think we have to admit that. We've seen very healthy gains in employment for several years now. Inflation has remained low. I mean, the Fed in many ways could declare victory. Obviously, they're not going to do that and start pounding their chests or pounding on the table, because that'll lead to trouble for sure. But you know, I think the current approach has served us well to date, and maybe the reason for that is, of course, it's come out on top of a major financial crisis. As the crisis continues to fade into the background, I think the Fed is going to have to reassess their approach. I don't think that necessarily means they'll get real aggressive, but I think it does mean they're going to have to reassess the approach because the hangover from the financial crisis is clearly diminishing.
What does this Federal Reserve look like in 2018? If Janet Yellen doesn't stick around, there's a huge opportunity here for the president-elect to pick as many as five new people at the Fed. There are these calls for a more rules-based system by members of Congress. What does the Fed look like in a couple of years?
Well, I think you're right. There'll be new players for sure. And presumably, I don't know how ideological they'll be, but they'll be presumably people that the Republican majority and the new administration are comfortable with. Whether that'll go to a rules-based approach, I think that issue will be on the table and will clearly be on the table and will stay on the table. Whether it gets resolved, I doubt it'll get resolved in the next 2 years. Whether it'll get resolved, say, in the next four or five, that will depend. Your question is right on target. That'll depend on who the players are and whether they embrace, if the Fed policymakers, the Board of Governors, embraces a rules-based approach, my guess is they won't have any trouble getting Congress to go along. If they oppose it, then it's going to be more of what we've had recently. Lots of disagreement, but, you know, people on both sides of the question. We need lower rates, we need higher rates, we need rules, we don't need rules, da-da-da-da-da.
Some news here crossing the Bloomberg I want to get in here. VW said to agree with regulators to fix about 60,000 diesel cars. These are the tainted 3-liter cars that have been the subject of much scrutiny and controversy. VW said to have avoided about $4 billion in paying to buy back all of those cars. Again, VW going to fix them. That news crossing the Bloomberg right now. We're here with Gary Stern, former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Let me ask you lastly here about Minnesota. We saw in the run-up to the election, Donald Trump saying the state was solidly in play, fighting for it when a lot of pollsters thought that was folly. What was it that resonated in Minnesota from what Donald Trump had to say economically?
Well, it's certainly true, I think, that Minnesota turned out to be closer between Trump and Clinton than expected. And I think part of it was the same thing you see nationally. That is, his message resonates with people in rural areas, in smaller towns, people who feel they haven't shared in the benefits of the economic growth and the improvement of the economy that we've had since the crisis, and maybe for a decade or more. Part of it is also that Minnesota, which used to be a very solidly Democratic state, you know, the suburbs and exurbs around Minneapolis, I think, are more Republican than the national press realizes, and are more inclined to vote Republican, at least on occasion. And I think that's just demographics and a nature of the people who work and live in those areas. And I don't think there's anything unique about Minnesota. I think that's what you see.
Gary, thank you very much. Gary Stern there, former president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, joining us here in the studios in New York. Janet Yellen, of course, preparing to head to Capitol Hill on Thursday to testify before the U.S. Joint Economic Committee.
Our guest that we hope to go to here in a moment is a very special guest. Jean-Claude Trichet, you've heard me say many times, folks, is the engineer from Nancy. He has the most original economics. It has always the feeling of control and the plug-in of engineering, the thinking of engineering, and that's something that we value greatly. Mr. Trichet, of course, coming after Mr. Duisenberg and before Mr. Draghi, is a president of the European Central Bank, is someone who managed through crisis. There was accolade and there was criticism, and now joining us, Jean-Claude Trichet. On my trip to London, Mr. Trichet, and good morning, my trip to London, clearly the talk is of Italy. How urgent is the moment for an Italy that must come to grip with slow economic growth?
Well, I think really that Italy is a conundrum because on the one hand, you have a very, very solid manufacturing sector, which is keeping its market share quite well, and can be compared really to what you see in Austria and the south of Germany. And on the other hand, you have this long-standing stagnation of the economy. I can explain that only because mismanagement in part of Italy, particularly, I would say, public management in the south of Italy, is absorbing the surplus that Italy is producing in its manufacturing sector. So they have really to embark on a very solid management of the public side, if I may, of the economy. And I trust that it is possible, but it's difficult. But it calls for structural reforms, and it calls for eliminating largely, you know, the kind of clientelism which exists in Italy, and particularly in the south.
Mr. Trichet, I've always kidded you about your engineering and your foundation approach to economics. How can we have a European economics amid negative rates? Do you know where the risk-free rate is? David Gurr and I are going in search of it, and we can't find it. Is the risk-free rate out there somewhere?
Well, it is clear that very low rates for a very long period of time, even if necessary from the, I would say, economic standpoint and from the looking at the real equilibrium rate standpoint, which are very, very low or even negative in some cases, including, I would say, in all advanced economy, despite the necessity of having these negative rates in some cases, not only, as you know, in the euro area, but also in Switzerland, also in Sweden, also in Denmark, and also in Japan, of course, they are negative consequences that we have to fully take into account. So, in my opinion, all taken into account, the advantages were superior to the inconveniences and to the drawbacks. But, of course, it cannot last forever. So I hope very much that we will get out of that situation and have, which is very important, of course, inflation expectations going back to the present definition of price stability, which is the same, by the way, in Europe, in the US, in Japan, namely around 2%, as we say in Europe, below 2%, but very close to 2%. So that is the key, of course. The key is really that the central banks in their present fight will succeed. And if they succeed, then we can get out of this difficult, I would say, period, which has, of course, a lot of drawbacks.
We've reached you in Frankfurt, where it's Euro Finance Week. Give us a sense of how much of the conversation has been consumed with talk about the transition here in the U.S. Donald Trump coming in as president, how much of the conversation is focused on that and the effect that that will have on Europe and indeed on the ECB's plans?
I think, of course, it is something which is of the essence because the U.S. is the most important country economically, because the U.S. has an influence which is very, very important, because it clearly demonstrates that there is a level of frustration of the people and of the middle class in the advanced economy, which is shared very largely, not only in the UK, but also in the US, and certainly in many European countries. So it is something which is very important, I would say, both for political reasons and also for economic reasons, because the market are expecting a new course of action. We will see. I mean, we have to be very, very prudent. You might remember the result of the vote was considered very negatively, then very positively in some respect. I think we have to be cautious, prudent on the economic side, on the monetary side, on the exchange rate side. Things are not moving that, you know, rapidly and so forth. So I remain myself very prudent. But what is absolutely clear is that we are in a universe where, because of the competition of the emerging economies,
right,
because of the rapidity of the surge of technology,
right,
we have a frustration, we have a stress of our people.
Well, Minister, thank you so much, Jean-Claude Trichet, this morning from Europe. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.